New Orleans, October 1972. I've arrived in America to begin playing the biggest role of my life. This is me, newly bonded in Live and Let Die. Suave and skilled, even though I say it myself, outmaneuvering the baddies at breakneck speed. It's my first time in a powerboat, and learning to corner one of these powerful beasts at 60 miles an hour takes nerves of steel. I wouldn't say I'm out of my depth, but the water is tickling my nipples. They say when death is imminent, your entire life flashes in front of your eyes. The only thing flashing before my eyes was a large corrugated shed. I knew I was going to hit it, and there wasn't a damn thing I could do about it. I would end up in a heap on the floor, clutching my mouth, my knee throbbing, my shoulder numb. Here I was about to start playing James Bond with no teeth. But that's just a little taste of what's to come. It's not where this story starts. So, where do we begin? Over to my son, Jeffrey, who's rooting round my old house.
I mean, this is basically Roger's, our shrine of the old man. These are Roger's ashes.
A dark-haired man roots about in a storeroom.
No.
Hang on about. Oh, I think this is it.
Home movies on videotape.
I think my eyesight is really gone because I can't focus anymore.
Get that camera away from me.
There's roughly about 40 tapes.
Oh, hello, Mr. Moore.
Look how much we
do. Do myself. Ha ha, that's me. Oh, cars, quickly.
Jenny, get out of the Ferrari.
A white Ferrari drives by.
What was that you were saying, Bord, about not being able to eat anymore?
Marcelli does.
Keeps flashing up. There's not enough light, that's what it is.
Oh, it's coming to the light, Johnny.
This film features previously unseen home movies and personal archive. Kirk Douglas singing and a woman jumping into a swimming pool. Dickie and David Attenborough, then Elton John.
I lived a pretty glamorous life, somehow becoming one of the world's most famous and desirable stars. When people asked me about the biggest character I played, I always answered, of course, it's the world's most loved spy.
Ah, James.
But my greatest creation?
Ladies and gentlemen, Roger Moore.
Mr. Roger Moore.
Roger Moore.
Well, the truth is, my greatest creation was somebody called Roger Moore.
This is me.
From Roger Moore, with love.
Well, the truth is, my greatest creation was somebody called Roger Moore. Roger Moore. Roger Moore.
Roger's words are loosely based on his diaries, memoirs, and interviews.
Roger Moore.
Steve Coogan. Then Dame Joan Collins.
Well, the first time I met Roger, I came home from school, standing in the hallway of our apartment flat in Great Portland Street, which also doubled as my father's agency, because he had the Will Collins agency, was this incredibly handsome young man. And I almost went weak at the knees. He walked towards me and said, oh, you must be Joan. My name's Roger Moore. I think I was swinging my satchel. I said, oh, yes, hi, how are you?
My manager called me on the phone and said, Gloria, they want to see you for a Bond movie. I said, oh, you're kidding. And Roger walks in. I said, oh, my God. And I said, Gloria, be calm. He was so handsome.
He just has it. When he looks at you, you feel like he's just looking at you and no one else. As a woman, you just go, wow.
I was 11 years of age, and we went to Battersea Park, Mom and my dad. Roger was there signing autographs, and I queued up. That's how I met Roger Moore, the only man's autograph I ever got.
When they asked me about this,
interview. I thought, well, you know, to talk about people I know, I'm not so crazy about doing that generally. But in the case of Roger, you know, Roger was so good-natured. He was so generous as an actor on the set with his time and hospitality. I thought this was an opportunity to, you know, say thanks.
It was my birthday. It was like 8 o'clock in the morning and I got a call. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear David. Happy birthday to you. I said, thank you for calling me. I'm lying in bed naked. He went, so am I. I said, it's a shame we're not together. He said, I know. I'm flirting with James Bond.
You shut your eyes.
Vous fermez les yeux. And vous faites bang.
That's the way you shoot.
Okay.
If you don't want to play Bond. If you want to play Bond, you just
mais pour
shoot
Bond,
bang like that.
Il tire tout de suite.
Yeah.
Immediately.
Immediately.
Can he do it from the back? You peut le faire en se tournant?
What, like that?
Mm-hmm.
Of course.
What else can he do?
Make love.
You may think I was born wearing black tie and cradling a martini. But nothing could be further from the truth.
A London bus.
I was born in October 1927 in Stockwell, then a working-class area of South London. There I am. Look at those cheeks. Ripe for squeezing.
Billy, his mother, was a kind, nice woman. She was extraordinarily beautiful, you know. You could see where Roger came from, and she was a lovely-looking woman, yeah. George was a bluff old policeman playing his banjo around the place, you know.
They weren't rich. They were working class. My grandmother worked in a tea room, and my grandfather was, you know, on the beat.
One would suspect if you're from that strata, you'd be talking like this. I thought all those people talk like that.
And you're terribly, hello. You know what I mean?
Well, my father.
I don't want to say you're pretentious. No, 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 that would be wrong.
No, my father was a very posh policeman.
Oh, was he?
From an early age, I perfected the art of pretending to listen. 50% of the actor's craft. At school, I sailed through my exams, orals and all. Was I a little chubby? Maybe. But when they called me tall, fat and ugly, that was a little harsh. By 17, I was shy and gangly and didn't know what I was going to do with my life. But a simple twist of fate on a dark and stormy night would bring me my big break in the shape of my first real mentor, film director Brian Desmond Hurst.
Roger's father was investigating a robbery at Brian Desmond Hurst's house in Belgravia. He was just going through the interactions that happened as a policeman visiting a victim. And then somehow into that, and Roger never explained exactly how, he was introduced to Brian Desmond Hurst. He was a flamboyant, gay, Oscar Wildean man. Brian at the time was in his first kind of flush of success as a filmmaker, but he was also someone who loved young men.
Caesar and Cleopatra was an epic film with a huge budget. As director, Brian could do what he liked. And what he liked was Roger Moore in a toga. Can you see me in this cast of thousands? No, neither can I. So that's my origin story. A star-struck father and a Roman miniskirt. I don't know what Brian Thorpe was beneath it, but I owe everything to his imagination. Anyway, let's just say that by the time I became famous, I'd learned to embellish things a little.
And either I had a long spear or a short toga, but I was noticed, you know, by the director who said, you know, do you want to be an actor? Why not?
Clearly, Brian Desmond Hurst saw something inside me. I know what you're thinking, and it wasn't that. He became a mentor to me. Okay, it was a little My Fair Lady, but through Brian, I learned how to dress, how to hold a room, and how to tell a tale. He spoke with my father and even offered to pay my fees for drama school. I was going to RADA.
I went to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art.
Oh, my.
Where they taught me, I suppose, to speak posh.
RADA concentrated a lot on elocution. You had to have a received English pronunciation, upper-class accent.
You know, I loved RADA for two reasons. First, I developed the voice, which would eventually become my trademark. And second, almost all of my classmates were female. I may not have learned much about acting, but I did begin to unravel the mysteries of the fairer sex. One of them would become my first wife, Dawn Van Steen. By God, for the next 8 years, that woman had me in a spin.
There's a box full of treasures here. A lot of secrets in this box. My name is John Van Steen. My mother married Roger Moore, and he became my stepfather. Here's some love letters. Darling Dawny, precious heart, I'd love to hold you and kiss you and feel your baby body in my arms. You snooker little angel puss. Oh God, yellow pussy, how I should like to spank your wonderful, pimply, goose flesh bottom. Well, darling, precious, good night, and God bless you, your own ever loving, ever faithful husband, Roger. P.S. I'd love to bite your bottom.
Yes, thank you, Sean. No one wants to hear this. What can I say? I was smitten and she was bitten.
My mother was vivacious and mesmerizing. He was besotted with her. She was 6 years older than him. She liked the young studs. What can I say? The picture of her ice skating in Monte Carlo. That was her passion. She loved it. He learned to skate just to be next to her. Roger was dishwashing anything he could find to make a few pence. Dawn was busy ice skating around the world. So he was my mother and my father.
This wasn't quite what RADA had trained me for.
He used to take me to Clapham Common, help me sail my little toy yacht that he bought me. Yeah, 18 years old. You think back to when you were 18. You didn't want to be lumbered with a kid. They're so sweet, gentle, kind. He was my hero.
A black and white photo of Roger and Dawn together.
Dawn was constantly away, and when we did see each other, she harangued me about my dreams of becoming an actor. She once told me, "You'll never be an actor. Your face is too weak, your jaw is too big, and your mouth's too small." How kind.
Intense love and intense bitchiness. And she was a real bitch to him.
So it's 1952. There I was, living in a one-room flat, looking after a 9-year-old, washing dishes, modeling knitting patterns for a living, and getting occasional jobs as a film extra. Little did I know that in 4 years I'd be starring opposite Lana Turner in a Hollywood movie. You might well be asking, how did that happen? I could thank Brian for teaching me the value of old-world charm and Dawn for bringing out my inner poet. But for the most part, it was thanks to wife number two. Singer Dorothy Squires. Or Dot to her friends.
Dorothy Squires, she was something else.
Oh, I remember Dorothy Squires very well. She was a big chapter in Roger's life.
She was a wild lady. Terrifying, actually.
People, when they come in and see you, they want to see glamour. This is what they want, an escape.
She was a huge star. She'd been a star since the 40s, worldwide hits.
She bought this wonderful house in Bexley, which had 22 rooms, 4 acres of land and a swimming pool. It was like Hollywood. And she'd have these parties and everybody'd turn up. And there'd be Shirley Bassey there, there'd be Diana Dawes, Cliff Richard was there. I was sat next to one guy, I said, who's this? He said, it was Phil Spector. Now, I mean, you don't expect to be sitting next to Phil Spector in Kent, do you? When Dot had a party, everybody went. That's where she met Roger, of course.
The telephone went, I picked up the telephone, and he said, I'm at the station. I said, who are you? Roger Moore. Well, I said, well, what do you look like? So he said, I'm short, fat, and bald. So I went back and I said, somebody go down the station and get a short, fat, bald guy, you know. I said, how do you do? Would you have a drink? So he said, I have an ulcer. So, oh, I said, I am sorry. Oh, he said, don't be sorry. It's quite fashionable. And I thought, oh, what a bore. It's quite fashionable. And I thought, who writes his script, you know?
She said, well, the last train must be gone by now, Dorothy. So we'd have to bloody stay there, won't you? And he picked her up, carried her up this Gone with the Wind staircase. And that was it. That's how it started.
He carried me upstairs. And I thought, what the hell? And I watched him go down the lawn the following morning. I thought, what the hell have I done? I've never slept with anybody in my house like that before.
Dot was a good 12 years older than me, and she was in another league. I was now mingling with top musicians, actors, and agents. And Dot had big plans for me.
She was the one that pushed him. He took advantage of it. Dorothy's my auntie. I remember she said to me once, why wouldn't you do this if you loved him?
She took him to America because she had lots of connections. She said to Roger, you know, they like handsome guys. You're struggling here. You like your photo sessions for, like, knitting patterns. You got to go to America.
In the summer of 1953, Dawn and I were divorced. Dot became wife number two, and we were headed for Hollywood.
I think she moulded him. He's 23, and he's got this charismatic woman who's a huge star. She told him to get his teeth done. He's going to listen to her, isn't he?
I was young and living in the moment. It wasn't until years later that I came to appreciate just how much Dot did for me. She had that secret ingredient, and somehow, a little rubbed off.
The great things I learned from Dorothy was to become my own person. I used to be very, very nervous, rather timid. From the time I met Dorothy, I then started developing a persona. I became somebody called Roger Moore. Roger Moore. Roger Moore.
And Roger Moore was about to become somebody. MGM offered me a 7-year contract. The character I'd created seemed to be having the desired effect. I was to play opposite Lana Turner. I didn't ask to keep the tights.
Look out for your hearts, girls. This Roger Moore is going places in pictures. He's quite a fellow.
2 years ago, I'd been eating beans on toast every night. Now I was sampling some of the finer dishes. And I don't mean the food.
He said, Lana Turner, you know? And then I went, yeah, yeah. And he said, Lana Turner teaching Roger from London to kiss, you know? This is kind of elevated sense of, you know, winning the lottery and really knowing you're winning the lottery. Your number is 546, you won, kiss her.
Hollywood life was wonderful. We met Elvis, a big fan of Dot's. I was rubbing shoulders with the stars. Many of them became lifelong friends. Here, captured by my own trusty camera many years later, is a very memorable visit from a Hollywood legend.
Gorgeous, gorgeous.
My old pal, Kirk Douglas.
Specialmente fra la rosa primavera. Come bella va l'amore con grande.
Was that it?
Jeffrey,
could I have a retake, please?
I sang my goddamn heart.
We have a retake, right?
Other dear friends I made around this time were David Niven, Gregory Peck, and Old Blue Eyes himself, Frank Sinatra.
They met in the late 50s in Los Angeles and became close friends.
Hey, Raj.
You are a generous and caring person and a hell of a classy guy.
Frank, he wanted all the men to sit around and drink with him. I remember Dad trying to keep up with Frank. Come on, Roger. It's not time to go to bed now. And he's like, you know, it was extraordinary. So Dad and all the men used to walk around with their whiskies and sort of put them in the plant pots because they just could not keep up with Frank.
Salute.
So I was fortunate to have played a bit part in the golden age of movies. But back in the late 50s, I didn't realize how short-lived my dream would be. First, my marriage began to fall apart. Dot already had fame. What she wanted most was to be a mother.
She was always a bit worried about not having children, and Roger did want to have children.
I wanted a baby. I had my fallopian tubes blown in England, but it wasn't a success, so I had them done in Beverly Hills.
She told me afterwards that she'd had three miscarriages.
My heart broke for Dot. We'd arrived in America with such high hopes, but within a few years, both our dreams began to fall apart. Dot couldn't get pregnant. And Diane, the movie that was supposed to catapult me to stardom, flopped. Quote, by mutual consent, MGM and Roger Moore have terminated their contract. There was nothing mutual about it, and the stigma from that kind of failure left me with only one option. Television.
I'm at home, I'm at home.
I now had a ridiculous plumed helmet to go with the tights, and 36 inches of flashing steel. The dialogue was medieval.
He's making for the dungeons. Thank you, Bruno. Now I know the way.
And my audience may all have been 12-year-olds, but I was the undisputed king of the playground.
The Alaskans. Starring Roger Moore.
Here I was in yet another popular period piece for television.
Dorothy Provine.
But for me, TV just didn't have the cachet, or the cash, of cinema.
Hello, my baby.
However, working in television did have certain advantages.
Send me a kiss.
Now, the rumor was that he liked the ladies. And the rumor was true, of course.
Dorothy Provine was my co-star.
Hey, now, come on, show it to me.
What can I say? We had an on-screen chemistry that continued off it.
Now, where's that $100 you borrowed from me?
Now, don't worry about that. I have a gold mine here, I think.
Dorothy found out that he was having an affair because he was talking in his sleep. She woke up in the night and she said, you bastard, you're having an affair with that Dorothy Provine. Well, what are you talking about, Dorothy? I'm not... She said, yes, you were. You were calling her name out in his sleep. She said, well, your name's Dorothy. She said, yeah, but you call me Dot. Got him.
We were driving between the sound stages on the lot. He said, if we see Dorothy Provine, he said, because I've fallen out with her, because I've packed up with her and that, she's doing this business now. Every time I see her and things, she sticks her nose in the air and goes all haughty and walks by and that. And sure enough, as she saw us, the nose went in the air and round the corner she walked. And Roger and I continued on our way, just giggling and laughing.
May 1961. Dot was away touring Australia, and I flew to Italy. The good news? I was in a film at last. The bad news? I was back in a toga. But the gods had brought me to Rome for a reason. A rather gorgeous Italian reason. Luisa Mattioli.
Well, my mother said they were watching something on television in Italy, and my mother's mother turned around to my mother and said, that's the sort of man that you should marry. And it was Dad in, I think, something like Ivanhoe, was one of those things that had been dubbed into Italian.
Luisa had accomplished a lot in her career, you know, from racing car driver, and then she was one of the first Miss Italy's and one of the first TV presenters in Italy as an actress and a singer.
She had a name for herself, and she had a beautiful voice. Her mother was an opera singer.
She was somebody that was a real go-getter.
This producer of the film that she was going to be in had said to her, there's an American actor coming, Roger Moore. Can you go meet him at the airport? And, you know, just, you know, make him feel at home, whatever, bring him into Rome. So that's how they met. He didn't speak a word of Italian, she didn't speak a word of English.
Ciao, hello, my name is Roger, ciao. It must have been very strange. It was on a film called The Rape of the Sabine Women.
Don't laugh, these movies were all the rage in the 60s. The low cost of labor in Italy meant you could afford huge crowd scenes like this one. With all these Italians, it was down to me to keep the British end on.
Ascoltatemi.
Just ignore the dodgy dubbing.
Un bambino è nato, il figlio di Lavinia e di Lino. Il primo bambino di Roma è un maschio.
He was wearing some, you know, one of those centurion outfits, and she had the Greek goddess sort of hairstyle.
Guardate il primo cittadino di Roma.
My father asked my mother out for dinner one night, and he kept sort of pointing at his finger. He didn't have the ring on because he was filming. Like, he was going like this. And she thought he meant, will you marry me? And she was like, are you crazy? You know, I'm already engaged. And she was engaged to quite a well-known gynecologist. But I think they must have had this spark and they fell in love.
She had charisma. I could see why the old man was besotted with her.
She was absolutely beautiful. And you could understand why, you know, Roger had fallen madly in love with her.
What can I say? We spoke the international language of love. There was, however, the small matter of my wife.
He told me that he'd met this lovely actress. And so we looked at each other and said, oh, my God, this is going to cause a lot of trouble.
Roger moved in with Louisa. So Dorothy went round there and threw bricks through every window in the house, see? Roger came out apparently and grabbed her and said, you know, and they called the police. And he's got hold of her and he said, Dorothy, your hand is bleeding. She said, it's my fucking heart that's bleeding. Always very dramatic, Dorothy, see?
June 1962. I admit, in my personal life, I was no saint. Professionally, on the other hand...
Mr. Moore, why do you think you were chosen to play the saint?
Because Sean Connery wasn't available.
The saint was what I'd been waiting for. He would be the Roger Moore I'd spent many years and two marriages perfecting.
Come, darling. I want you to meet the most fantastic man. I've told you about him. John, this is Simon Templar.
No swords, no sandals, no armor, not even a toga. Instead, it was a cool car, a stiff drink, and some sharp suits.
Monsieur Simon Templar.
He was the foundation for the rest of my career. Simon Templar. Or if you like, Simon Template.
Simon Templar is a thief, the modern Robin Hood. We never show how I live, where do I get my money from. And so he is a man with a past, which always makes a leading man more interesting.
I was 11 years of age, and I used to draw the saint on our textbooks. Or you'd write, you know, you draw the saint on the back of your hand. There's something very magical about it. It was a massive breakthrough for Roger the Saint. He created his own look, his own life, his own image.
The image of the saint for me was all wrapped up in the cool of black and white film. But by the end of the 60s, we looked even better in colour. Oh, look, there's Stephen Burkoff playing a mustachioed henchman, all in lovely duck egg blue.
What made him look famous? Is that he's had the most ridiculous haircut I've ever seen. His hair went all the way up, like that, with a quiff. I thought, that's a bit poncy even then.
I wanted to have hair like Roger Moore. I used to try and get my hair to look like Roger's.
Good looks, humour, and kindness. We were starting with a scene that was quite wordy. The director calls right action.
Mr. Williams, I heard about Owen Thomas.
And I do a part of the scene.
I saw the lights of the search party from the house.
Suddenly he starts screaming, cut, cut, no, we'll have to do it again. What is that? And I'm sort of like this, you know. And I'm standing waiting for the cue, and I feel a hand on my hand and holding it. And I look up, and there's Roger looking at me, and he said, don't let him worry you. He does this all the time. And then he walked just very nicely, very quietly down to the director, had a few words. I never had any trouble again throughout the entire episode.
Thanks for rescuing me in there, Mr.
Templar, Simon Templar. It was a pleasure.
That put him on the map. That put him in all our hearts. Once Roger found Roger in life, Roger became Roger and embellished Roger, which is a great talent unto itself.
You know, I think to some degree, actor or not, we all invent ourselves. You know, we decide somewhere, probably very young, who we'd like to be, who we imagine ourselves as. You know, becoming a hero of our own story.
The Saint was sold to over 60 countries around the world, reaped more than £350 million in profit.
Roger Moore's there to make the presentation.
And made me a household name from Bogota to Bognor Regis.
Deborah Moore.
I used to drive my grandmother crazy because she would take me to the park and there would be like the swings and the slides and everything like that. And she said that I was the most embarrassing grandchild because I'd get on the top of the slide and go, my daddy's famous, my daddy's the saint.
I'd say that Roger Moore never had it so good. What is the attraction behind playing in these long-running series?
Money.
The Saint have made me both rich and famous. I had two wonderful children, a beautiful home, and a woman who, shall we say, put the lead in my pencil. But for 9 years, Dot's refusal to sign on the dotted line and give me a divorce cast a pretty dark shadow over my success.
I always felt that she put him where he was. He wasn't anything before her, and he was after her.
She never got over him, ever. Never got over him.
Look, this is when he loved me, actually. See?
Became an obsession, I suppose.
Sadly, Dot's efforts to hold on to me became increasingly desperate.
And that's, this is the jacket.
It was really bad. She did everything she could. She was determined, you're not going to get away from me. No way.
I remember one time I was staying with my grandparents and my mother got a phone call. She thinks it was Dorothy or somebody with Dorothy saying that I'd been kidnapped.
She got into the litigation. Roger Moore and Eloisa were at some gala on TV and Kenneth Moore was the MC.
Now, Roger and Eloisa Moore.
And he introduced them as Mr. and Mrs. Moore. You said that was Mrs. Moore. No, I'm Mrs. Moore. That's Luisa Mattioli. It's not Mrs. Moore. So she sued him. She sued everybody. 20 court cases. That's how she lost a lot of money.
Luisa arrives at a registry office.
The 11th of April, 1969.
She and Roger pose for photographs.
Finally, after 9 long years, Dot agreed to a divorce. Louisa and I were married at Caxton Hall. It was meant to be a small ceremony, but 600 people came to watch.
A crowd look on as the couple leave in the back of a car.
She hardly spoke English, but she was so beautiful and funny.
We did lots of family pictures and group pictures. One of her favourite remarks when we're all sitting there is, oh, try to look pretty. Louisa was enchanting. She would ring me sometimes and she'd go, hello, I want to speak in a letter. And I'd say, oh, hello, Louisa. And she'd say, oh, you know it's me. And I'd say, because nobody else speaks English like you, Louisa. Oh, you know it's me.
It was a restaurant called The White Elephant where everybody congregated. And this beautiful girl comes in with the hot pants, little velvet hot pants. You know, even as a woman, it was really extraordinary. And Louisa goes to Roger and slaps him across the face. He said, well, what's that for? And she said, just in a case. It's a true story.
We formed a club. It was Roger's idea. Michael Caine and his wife Shakira, Leslie Brickus, the brilliant songwriter, and his wife Evie, Brian and me, and Roger and Louisa. We would just get together, and we called ourselves the See You Next Tuesday Club. Roger loved it, and we loved it.
Now that there are so many years, you are Simon Templar. Do you still like this man?
He's kept me in good clothes, good food, good company. Of course I like him.
Simon Templar has given me confidence and class. My South London upbringing was by now a distant memory.
Oh, you're starless. You're so bright. Your carriage awaits. I'm not
so playing an English lord in The Persuaders...
It's got a hat.
...wasn't too big a stretch.
Let me carry your train for you, sir.
Daniel, you really do bring a fresh meaning to the word peasant.
Your dukeship, anyhow.
I shared top billing with Hollywood legend Tony Curtis, who played Danny Wilde, a Brooklyn kid made good.
Roger was perfect. See, Roger had this attitude of an English lord, Lord Sinclair, you know? He already was the Lord Sinclair, could have been in movies, handsome Englishman. Thank you very much.
The show was built around beautiful women, fast cars, and glamorous locations.
I got a call from Roger. Joni, I want you to come to the south of France to do The Persuaders with me and Tony Curtis. I said, oh, wow, that sounds great. He said, well, we'll put you up in a hotel. I thought, well, this is nice.
It's a hard life being an actor, isn't it?
Why didn't you switch that thing off?
I think I'll switch that thing off.
I was a photographer. I was very bohemian, somewhat avant-garde.
You may kiss me.
Roger does so.
Kissing Roger was fine. Kissing Tony was like kissing an ashtray.
Fine.
Is this an excuse me or can we all join in?
Sorry.
I like it.
It was The Persuaders that added the final piece of the jigsaw to my repertoire, something that would become my trademark.
Well, you must forgive him. His early life was influenced rather heavily by Rudolph Valentino.
A soup song of tongue-in-cheek humour.
There's no need to kneel. I'm a very democratic lord.
With Lord Brett Sinclair, I had become an upper-class gentleman. Literally. I'd gone from a one-room flat in South London to a mansion in Buckinghamshire.
Roger picks up a child on a film set.
Maybe growing up and having to provide for a family was the making of Roger Moore. All these TV roles, Ivanhoe, The Saint, The Persuaders, had me playing the hero, saving damsels in distress. From them, I had put together the voice, the charm, a modicum of comic timing, and the ability to look half-decent in a suit. And out of one. All I needed to make my life complete was to get back on the big screen.
From Roger goofing around with Joan Collins in behind-the-scenes footage to a country mansion.
And then, one day, the call I'd been waiting for finally came.
The three last digits were 007007. And he answered your phone with 007, because that's what you do. And the voice said, That you are, Roger. He must have played down. Oh, great, that's wonderful. Louisa!
We had a drink. He said, I've got some great news. I've got some great news.
Gin, gin.
Everybody was thrilled and we toasted the new 007. I said, can I be a Bond girl?
Burt Reynolds.
Roger Moore is an amazing man because he seems to be a very humble human guy who lets it all sort of hang out.
You're talking about all of us.
No, I'm not. He now, as you all know, is the new James Bond and is going to be, if not already, an enormous major motion picture star.
A brief glimpse of Roger driving a high-speed boat, then debris floating on the water.
Following my speedboat crash, I was carted off to the clinic where the doctor gave me the good news that my leg wasn't broken and my wife, Louisa, gave me the most un-James Bond-like news that I'd made a mess of my underwear. The speedboat incident did nothing to calm the nerves. Not mine, and certainly not that of my bosses Harry Saltzman and Cubby Broccoli.
I do remember when they brought me out to New Orleans. I don't know that he was nervous, but they were nervous about him.
The studio bosses wanted a big American name, Paul Newman or Steve McQueen. But Cubby and Harry fought for yours truly, and I was forever grateful.
Everyone was nervous about anyone replacing the Bond, who was Sean.
Connery just took the world by storm. Bond.
A martini, shaken, not stirred.
And Roger had to pick up that mantle. Very demanding because Connery had made such an indelible impression.
Sean had established the role and was a diamond in the rough. And Roger was a well-honed diamond.
He had this charm about him, he had a casualness that seemed to go with the times.
Such a delicate touch.
Sheer magnetism, darling.
When I met him, the first thing he was trying to do was make sure he could shoot this silver magnum thing without going like that every time. Every time he looked like that, so he definitely had a problem and he was not looking Bond-like to go every time.
And then came the line that would determine whether I would succeed or fail. I'd practiced it over and over. But no matter how many times I said it, in my head I always heard the same thing. I was terrified I would open my mouth and out would come,
my name is Bond, James Bond, and I mustn't do that.
The first proper scene I remember doing with him, you know, the first time he said, I'm Bond, James Bond, I was terrified. It was scary.
Oh. All right. What's my name? James Bond. James Bond.
My name's Bond. James Bond.
Yeah, that's a big, big name to say.
Gloria Hendry, co-star.
The weather turned suddenly colder today, but the chill in the air warmed under the sunny smile of Gloria Hendry, whose entry into the French Quarter in Courtyard was straight out of a Bond movie. Would you believe that? The overall effect is, wow. That's a compliment. So here we are on the set. This guy said to me, stay out of the sun, because my God, it was burning up and I'm on top of him. So the night before, I had a lot of garlic.
James.
He said, you're lucky my wife is Italian.
In the movie, Roger points a gun at Gloria.
This was one of the first major films that had an interracial relationship. It was quite a remarkable thing for the time.
I couldn't believe my luck. Glorious Gloria and sensational Seymour.
He was just incredibly helpful to me as a young actress. I remember when we did the love scene and the famous deflowering love scene.
I just need a little bit of information, that's all.
The eyebrow was the hugest issue. Every time his eyebrow went up, they went, cut, Roger, the eyebrow.
I've lost it.
They thought that he could choose to do it or not do it, but he couldn't. That's just how he'd be. That was his thing.
Ah, yes, my eyebrow. Some say I built a career on it.
The very singular ability to manipulate his left eyebrow. The eyebrow would go... Bzzz. That was... How can he do just the one eyebrow?
That furry little fella seduced the world. And so did I.
From Pierce Brosnan raising an eyebrow to an airliner taking off.
We wrapped filming on Live and Let Die, and all I could do was wait and hope. Wait to see what the critics would make of my Bond, and hope, well, hope the buggers liked it.
What about the Bond reviews now? Are you ready for that?
I tell you what, I think the good critics in America are the ones who liked it.
It's just that you have to go through the envy barrier. They will try to destroy you because they also feel that they made
you.
Yeah,
but you see, they don't decide who becomes a star. The people decide who becomes a star.
Oh, that's very good.
It's a good thing it's the people who decide, because the critics were not impressed.
It's Live and Let Die. Roger Moore is James Bond, 007.
Our box office, on the other hand, was in rude health.
It's Live and Let Die.
We were off to the races.
Ladies and gentlemen, Roger Moore.
The success of Live and Let Die meant I was very much in demand on the chat show circuit.
Roger Moore.
This was where the Roger Moore character I'd built so carefully could really shine.
You seem perfect. Are you proposing or something?
No, nothing like that.
You just seem perfect.
He had it all, I would say. He seemed to really, really enjoy it, to make movies and be famous. He said I was one lucky bastard.
This, of course, consequently, causes a great number of women to be attracted to you all over the place, which, as everyone knows, can become extremely...
All over which place?
The entire globe. Which means that this can become tiresome and present problems to you as these ladies lay in waiting for you outside your hotel room door and other places too numerous to mention.
Is this a monologue?
The combination of his looks and his personality and his pleasantness and his humor and the fact that he liked me.
I'm trying to get to the question, and
He's not
think...
reading it either.
How do you handle all these women?
My wife looks after it for me. She's Italian.
Wife's Italian?
Yeah.
Then you have no problem at all.
I have no problem whatsoever.
It was hardly worth that long question, was it?
He was very amusing, pleasing as a personality. He was just the perfect talk show guest.
He was a laugh. I mean, there's a thing I remember Michael Caine said about him. If he hadn't been so good looking, they'd have let him be a comedian.
Is there anyone in England that's got that kind of zany, nutty, marvelous kind of humor?
No, not since I left.
Naughty sense of humor, really naughty. I mean, he'd start telling a story and everybody would go, oh, Roger, stop it, for God's sake.
I always wanted to be a comic. Well, the reason I wanted to be a comic was that when I did drama, everybody laughed. So I thought, well, I'm a comedian.
When I kill for Queen and Country. When I kill for Queen and Country. When I kill for Queen and Country. Though I admit killing you would be a pleasure. All right, enough larking about. Back to the day job. The Man with the Golden Gun began filming in Thailand. There was a lot riding on it. Despite the box office success of Live and Let Die, plenty of fans were still pining for Sean. They said I was too light. I've always been a lover, not a fighter. Director Guy Hamilton, however, wanted me ruthless.
Ah, you're hurting my arm.
I'll break it unless you tell me where those bullets go.
It didn't sit easily with me.
Try.
I wanted my Bond to be a bit of a romantic. Naturally, I suggested bedding Maud Adams to extract the information. The guy was insistent I toughen up.
You see what you can do when you try?
Where did you get the reputation for being such a male chauvinist pig? Somebody had that impression of you.
Through playing Bond.
I suppose that would be it.
I said where?
Playing Bond, yes, you get accused of male chauvinism.
And I could see why. This trailer is practically an advert for male chauvinism.
James Bond, on the job. The girls are willing.
In December 1974, The Man with the Golden Gun hit the cinemas. And the reviews weren't exactly glowing. The New York Times called me a vast garden ornament. The box office wasn't quite what we expected either. Terrifyingly, for my bank balance, I may have to go back to working in TV.
Man with the Golden Gun isn't really a financial success, so suddenly it all starting to look messy.
Can we talk about the knocks? People all said, oh, well, Roger Moore is not my idea of 007, and it's all a great failure. I mean, do you mind that kind of hammering?
No, it is always nice to get a good notice.
You do like a good notice. Yeah.
Well, of course you do, but you don't take any notice if they're bad. Mm. And so by the same token, I shouldn't take any notice of the good ones. Yes. Not that there are many, but still.
March 1976. Pinewood Studios. The Spy Who Loved Me goes into production. After my last Bond and the harsh reviews, I found my own way to deal with questions about my acting ability.
Have you ever forgiven the critic who called you a lump of English roast beef?
Yeah.
Can you find it in your heart?
Oh, sure I can. I know where I'd like to stick the mustard, too.
You're very self-deprecating about your acting. Is that defensive?
Yes, it's defensive. I always try to say it before anybody else does.
But if you didn't say it, perhaps nobody else would.
I never thought of that. Maybe I started the wrong way.
He was so self-deprecating that people joined in. But actually, you know, he was a very fine actor.
Why do you always put yourself down?
Well, I've stopped doing that.
You have?
No, I now say I'm marvellous.
You do? That's all right. What caused the change of heart?
The critics started believing.
Yeah, he was modest. He was maybe even shy. You know, he was so handsome that you forgot what a good actor he was.
He was never enormously confident, but he could give the impression of being confident.
The audience doesn't have to know what you're doing. They just have to know that you know what you're doing.
He was an actor and a movie star. And I think often movie stars, people don't give them the credit for the acting chops because they're so magnetic on screen that they think, well, that's just who they are.
Did you want me to go? I thought that I had to go down.
Oh, I want more straight away. Let's go.
I'd wrestled with the question of how to become James Bond with limited success. In the end, the answer was so simple. Stop trying to turn Roger Moore into James Bond. Turn James Bond into Roger Moore.
Hope you enjoyed the show. Good night.
He knew how to play Roger Moore. And that's a gift. That's a real, real gift.
If there's anything you would like, anything at all?
Well, I had lunch, but I seem to have missed dessert.
He said I had my stride. I always remember that. I had my stride with that. It's just great entertainment.
It was shocking just how much fun Jaws and I had in this electrifying scene.
This Spy Who Loved Me couldn't be more different to Live and Let Die, Man with the Golden Gun. We're now in quite a different world, in a way, a world when you have an underwater base and a world where you can have a sports car that turns into a submarine.
As you can see, it is noisy and it is cold.
Ready, action.
The whole crew couldn't wait to get to work in the morning. He was so entertaining. We almost used to have to allow half an hour a day for the jokes and the fun that was to go on.
People have to be willing to have a joke, and then it is fun, as you said before, an experience. It's raining on this set. You see, this is what I mean by being able to take a joke. I will go down and kill them in a second. Thank you very much, fellas.
And I love him in his naval outfit. He looks incredible.
A scene from The Spy Who Loved Me.
Your time's running out, Stromberg.
The worst thing that happened to me on The Spy Who Loved Me was the sequence, if you remember, where my final confrontation with Kurt Jurgens, Stromberg. Well, unfortunately, the chair blew up before I got out of it, and that did quite a lot of damage to my rear end.
And he leapt in the air with his backside on fire and ran round the set. Anyway, Roger had to have Vaseline dressings for 2 weeks, and afterwards said, I have got two holes where most people have one.
It's the biggest.
Despite the damage to my perfect posterior, the marketing team remained confident of my sex appeal.
We get that extra push, especially where the women are concerned, because they're less interested in the action aspects of the film. When you talk to them, they're more interested in Roger and sublimating themselves into the role of whatever woman he's making love to.
How that trim, John?
Editor and second unit director John Glenn was hard at work in the edit suite, cutting the opening sequence. It promised to be something rather special.
Tell you what would help it, if you were just a touch longer.
Yeah, okay.
I directed the pre-title sequence. I found myself in Mount Asgard on the Canadian Arctic. 3 weeks it took us to get this shot, this one shot. It was Roger's favourite action scene. He just loved it.
Bond, pursued by several enemies, escapes by skiing off the edge of a steep mountain.
And he's falling and falling and falling, and there's silence.
I remember watching that. You know, it's one of the most famous bits in cinema, isn't it?
Parachute opens. Doof.
When that Union Jack came up, oh boy, everyone goes bananas.
The movie had only been going for like 5 or 10 minutes.
Standing ovation.
You know, the reaction was incredible.
A day I never thought I'd see. But the reviews came in, and would you believe it? They were positive.
It is a fantastically entertaining movie. You've got a performance in Rogers that he knows he's there to give you a great time. If Spy Who Loved Me hadn't worked, it would have been very, very difficult, I think, for the franchise.
There was Roger coming down the mountain. Of course he saved the franchise.
But James, I need you.
So does England.
In reality, I had little in common with 007. Except perhaps a taste for the high life. Exotic locations, fancy cars, and a nice pair of gadgets.
These time-shifting devices, the portable VCR machine and home movie camera.
Gadgets, he loved his gadgets, especially the home video camera and the huge 5 kilo box you'd have to carry around with the battery pack. Recording life, such a novelty. You know, certainly from his childhood, where none of that existed.
Okay, more tapes.
All right, what's your name?
Christian Moore.
Christian Moore, what a horror you are. And there is Jeffrey.
It's roughly about 40 tapes. He liked to record, you know, what was going on, and here we are, look how beautiful it is, and Roger narrating.
Well, so right, now we're going to have impersonation.
Oh, hi! Oh, Roger!
I would rather come out and want to do all the people think. If others are pushing you to fart, they will come to realize you have
all push you to fart?
Push you to fart.
You could see more of the funny humor side of him.
I trust I'm the focus for these things because I get very upset about my parents.
Mucking about. Great memories, absolutely. There's a lot of south of France home footage. Jeffrey dug all this up, right?
Yeah.
No, I haven't seen it.
The card is not going to work. Can you come and look at it, please? The card.
Stephanie Powers.
Do you want to get a close-up on that?
I'm moving in for a close-up.
Do you want to get a close-up on that?
Oh, Stephanie.
Oh, and spin on it.
And just spin on that one.
They had so much fun. I mean, fun, silly fun, laughter, and it was a magical time of the year. It's like a dream.
Hi, Dali.
Okay, Valentino Portofino.
Fashion designer Valentino.
Olivia Newton-John. Yeah, that's probably here.
We're really shy.
Yeah.
Kind of hit me that we were surrounded by fame, but for us it was just they were just their friends. It wasn't, oh, he's famous, he's the, you know what I mean?
There's my favorite Bond girl, Maud Adams. And how's this for a shot straight out of the Bond playbook? Eat your heart out, cubby broccoli.
A swimsuited Maud jumps into a swimming pool.
All his friends would come around. Growing up, seeing his friends on TV, I thought that's what people did. They were in this little box and they'd come around.
The chopper's arriving in 5 minutes.
And the chopper's arriving 5 minutes.
Oh, is this Roger with his camera?
A helicopter comes in to land.
The noise, oh God. I mean, to land on a tennis court is really brave.
It touches down.
Who the hell is... Oh.
Elton John, wearing a cowboy hat, disembarks from the helicopter and runs into a house.
This is Elton. This is Elton arriving. Extraordinary. There's Joan.
That's lovely.
Is this the sound? Yes, the sound.
Roger never changed from the time I met him. He was always charming, funny, full of the joie de vivre, telling jokes.
No, it's quite amazing. The flora that you find on the hills of St. Paul.
The gorilla costume.
There you are.
It's just lovely to remember that day. You know, it's extraordinary. Walking back in time.
Enough of that.
I haven't seen this. This is like super duper emotional.
Roger, non dici niente.
Louisa, I'm waiting for you to say you're beautiful.
Chat.
I can't work until I know that you're lovely. A little kiss on the cheek.
Christian Moore looks emotional as he watches the footage.
And here we are at the birthday.
Life turned out pretty well. I had nice houses dotted around some lovely parts of the world. I had fancy cars and luxury yachts and good friends who happened to be famous. But, well, no, there is no but. I just had a really good life.
Little crumpets, harem. How much?
How much?
It was a very surreal childhood. I knew he was somebody important. A lot of people that I would recognize from film coming in. And at the age I was, I didn't like attention. I became very shy.
Well, it's a very nice static picture, you know.
This is a moving picture.
You know, I see pictures of myself always hiding behind my mother or my father.
When I first realized how famous he was, he came to pick me up at the school. All these kids were coming out, you know, around the car and stuff. And that's when I realized, you know, that they knew who he was. And anyone to know, because I thought that was, you know, son of James Bond and I looked like a donut. I thought it would be better to blend in.
Roger photographed with wife and children.
For me, fame was a choice. But there came a time when I felt my children deserved a more normal upbringing. So, reluctantly, we left England. And there were some tax benefits as well.
To the left here, Peter Sellers' house. That one up there, do you see it? It's a cool house. He was one of the first guys here, him, Niven, and obviously Rog. And then Burton, I mean, that was the Rat Pack here. And Julie Andrews' house, where the train is basically above those trees. I mean, it's all very nonchalant when you talk about these people. But, you know, these are family friends, and they're all in a make-believe world, you know? They're getting paid to make-believe, so they didn't take themselves very seriously.
What is the great attraction, do you think, for celebrities? Do they come here to get away from it all?
Well, we come up here because there are no such things as microphones and television cameras.
A lot of stars like Switzerland and like to live in Switzerland because the locals, they don't bother them. He loved it on the mountain. He was happy.
Despite my fabulous skiing exploits on screen, I couldn't actually ski. In my 50s, I decided to learn. Thanks to my wonderful instructors, I found swooping down the piste to be fairly easy. It was stopping I had a problem with.
We meant to stop here. And what happened? Roger panics. What happened? He went. The worst thing was that the metal edges of the skis on the concrete were sparkling, like you wouldn't imagine that, like in a film. And we flew through the terrace, kick a table, kick another, and we ended up here like an ostrich with a head plant on the table. And then Roger stands up.
Madam, a pleasure to make your acquaintance.
Well, that was wonderful, VJ.
For 6 more years and a further 4 films, I played the part. On and off screen.
Roger Moore, 007 for the 5th time and fit as a fiddle. How do you do it, dare I ask?
I play the fiddle.
The trailer for my final Bond film introduced Christopher Walken as my enemy.
This man has a secret ambition.
I propose to end the domination of Silicon Valley.
In real life, we became great chums.
$100 million.
I was a big Bond fan. So the idea of being a villain was very attractive. Max Zorin is a genetically altered human being. He drives a blimp, you know.
People looking up as the aircraft passes.
You know, who do you know? He drives it himself, you know, with switches. Pick you up in my blimp.
Action, Chris!
Physically, they're hard work. You're in every scene, and the schedule is usually about 6 months, and that means every day from the crack of dawn. So they're long hours.
It was a long shoot. We were about to break for Christmas, and he said to me on set one day, what are you doing for the holidays? And I said, well, I guess I'm just going to sit in my apartment. And he said, well, no, you come to my house in Switzerland. So I did.
Reporters greet Roger and Christopher as they arrive in the Swiss town.
He was very much the Roger that you saw on film. You know, he was funny, he was charming, he was handsome, he dressed well. Yeah, very much the same guy. He had a nice life.
Alas, old age catches up with all of us in the end. I think it was the moment one of my leading ladies told me I reminded her of her father that I decided it was time to hang up the Walther PPK.
He was getting too old. Simple. You know, I mean, he looked pretty good, but he was sort of knocking 60, and I think he was right to quit when he did.
I wanted to find a way to put my fame to good use. Audrey Hepburn, who was a UNICEF ambassador and a neighbor of mine in Switzerland, suggested I too become an ambassador. Upside, a chance to do something good. Downside, not a martini in sight.
I was exceedingly grateful to Audrey for having steered me in the right direction.
In 1991, my life, in a strange way, began to mirror that of my most famous character. I was sent to far-flung locations and war zones, but this time, I had a license to help people.
I'm so violently opposed to the use of weapons and mines that I didn't like that image of me going around the world holding the Walther PPK. It appears rather heroic, and it's not.
I had changed, and how I lived my life had changed. By 1993, the children had flown the nest. Louisa and I had been together for 30 years, but that relationship was also changing.
She was quite tough, Louisa, and she used to get very angry with him. A lot.
She did turn a little bit unkindly towards him, and she'd humiliate him at the table. I don't know why she did that.
I mean, it's tough because, you know, a lot of women would throw themselves over him, so it's a tough role. You know, she really had to put up with a lot.
When they were living in Stade, I went to stay with them. I said, Where's the bedroom? And Louisa said, this is my room. And it was a big, lovely bedroom. And Roger said, come and see mine. And so under the stairs, there was this little kind of cubby hole. And he said, this is where I sleep. And I didn't want to ask the obvious question, how's the marriage going?
You know, I think it was when he got slightly older, you know, they sort of drifted apart. And that made my mother very... very upset, very angry. She could tell that something wasn't right, and I think by that point he'd, you know, already met Christina.
Christina was a friend of Louisa's. She was calm and empathetic, and as the distance between Louisa and me grew, Christina and I became closer. She was such a different person to my wife.
Christian Moore looks sad as he remembers.
They just had spent 30 years together, and I think it was time for him to move on with his life and be happy.
My mother knew about it when she opened the newspapers, and there it was, the new woman in Roger Moore's life.
Phone call from my old man saying, kid, listen, it's just made news that, you know, I'm leaving. Okay, you better go see your mother.
Paparazzi would only come round when there was, like, a scandal. They were outside the flat.
And I go to open the door, and there's like... It's out there before you know it.
Oh, I found out from co-workers. It was in the papers, and someone threw it down.
Some people may have disapproved of Christina, or Kiki, as I called her, but she was a big support to me and came on many of my UNICEF trips.
Sir Roger Moore, for services to charity.
Arise, Sir Rog. Being knighted meant a lot to me. All the more so because it wasn't for services to entertainment, but for my charitable work. Luckily, I didn't have to wear tights.
There we are. Thank you.
In my later years, I found peace. I was very happy with Kiki. Of course, like many in old age, I had some health issues.
Spending the last few weeks in hospital with him, I had asked him if he was frightened, and he said no, that he enjoyed every minute of his life. I don't think he found regret in anything.
Doctor said, I'm really sorry, but I don't think he's gotten on to live. We went into the room and he said, right, I don't want bad news, I just want the good news. So we just put on a brave face and pretended that everything was going to be all right, you know, and it wasn't.
Deborah Moore.
I just sat and talked to him for a while. Held his hand and stuff.
Jeffrey Moore.
It slowly sunk in, you know. And I struggled because we always had a phone call. We always spoke every day at 11 o'clock. It took a while for me not to press the button. It's 11 o'clock, shit, they've got to call Roger. He's no longer here.
A photo of Roger in his prime.
How will Roger Moore be remembered? Well, I made over 60 movies in my career, but most people only ever wanted to talk about 7. When someone else became Bond, I enjoyed a new kind of fame as Roger Moore, National Treasure.
It is a huge honor to be entrusted by his family to hold this very special sale today. 32,000, 35,000, 38,000, £40,000 here.
Why anybody would want this stuff is beyond me. But, oh well, I'm glad they do.
Going once at 50,000.
At least some of this money will go to charity.
You're a brilliant bidder, thank you. You're there, 55,000. 60,000. Sold, 60,000. There we are. 107.
It's my dad, it's our father. I don't think he really fathomed who he was until after death. And we're all looking for Roger tonight. He's here in spirit.
Allow me to raise a glass and an eyebrow one last time. A toast to those who shared the journey with me.
He never forgot me. I never forgot him.
To those who made me what I was.
Before she died, the phone goes and it was Roger on the phone.
He said, take Dorothy's hand, squeeze it and say, Roger's thinking of her.
She smiled and she died.
And to my dear friends with whom I laughed and loved.
Oh, they're right on the cake, oh, there it goes.
I miss him. I suppose that's what this is about. Chance to tell him, you know, I never saw him again.
Roger wearing a safari suit.
Everyone will miss Roger, but the memories of what he brought us far outweighs that. Roger was timeless.
All that is left is to send my love to Dawn, Dot, Louisa, and Kiki.
Of course he was married 4 times. He was Roger Moore. You know, he had to let other people have a turn to be married to him. But, you know, who wouldn't? Who wouldn't? I'd have liked to have slept with Roger Moore. My mum would have liked to have slept with Roger Moore. We'd all like to have slept with Roger Moore.
Yeah, Roger Moore. What a guy.
A man becomes what he dreams. He dreamt well.
Did I save the world? Not really. But I put a smile on people's faces, did my bit, then buggered off. Always leave them wanting more. Roger Moore.
I am what I am. I am my own special creation. So come, take a look.